Well, the first thing I think he would do would be to stand up and tell the truth. I mean, he had a great expression that was just tell the truth and watch them scatter.
So the further away the problem is, the easier it is to postpone action on it. And that's essentially what we're doing.
Be real. Because people in New Hampshire are really cool.
I'd say get in the game. This is a problem facing your generation. You have to have a voice in the decision.
Welcome to Facing the Future, brought to you by the Concord Coalition on WKXL, New Hampshire's talk radio station. Tune in each week as we dive into topics related to fiscal policy, like healthcare, taxes, national security, the national debt, and more. You will hear discussions with experts, elected officials, and industry leaders on how the nation's fiscal and economic challenges impact current and future generations, and we'll explore some of the solutions. I'm your host and New England Regional Director for the Concord Coalition, Chase Hageman. This is the first of two year-end special editions of the show, where we will look back on past segments that I think are good reminders as we wrap up 2019 and help set the stage looking ahead to 2020. That being said, you will hear one segment this week, our remembrance of the late Alice Rivlin that took place back in May, featuring Concord's Executive Director Bob Bixby, who filled in for me as host, economist mom Diane Lim, Allison Acosta Winters from Americans for Prosperity, and Concord's National Field Director Phil Smith, all of whom at some point or another worked with Alice. Alice is certainly greatly missed, and her impact on others and the world around her is still being felt. In fact, you'll hear a lot about that from some of her former colleagues as they discuss her legacy and work in the world of fiscal policy in the upcoming segment. I know it might be somewhat of a somber topic for what is normally a very chipper, cheery holiday season, but I encourage you to think of it more as a celebration of a life well lived and an opportunity to follow in someone else's footsteps that led and set a great example. Merry Christmas and happy holidays. Enjoy your end of year celebrations. We'll be back after these short messages.
Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host today, Bob Bixby, and I'm joined on the show by Diane Lim, our regular economist mom. Diane is a principal at the District Economic Group. And another guest today is Allison Acosta Winter. Allison is Senior Policy Fellow in Economic Freedom at the Americans for Prosperity. And a special guest is Phil Smith, the Concord Coalition's National Field Director. And you might be wondering, what are our group of experts here today going to talk about? Well, we're all going to be remembering Alice Rivlin, who was absolutely I don't know what you could say. She was the standard of fiscal responsibility and budget policy and public service here in Washington. Alice passed away very recently at the age of 88, and we all knew her. We worked with her. And we all came to rely on her advice and cherished her as a colleague. So we thought we would maybe discuss a little fiscal policy, but in tribute to Alice. So let me begin, Diane. You probably knew Alice Rivlin longer than any of us here, going back maybe to your days at CBO. I thought you might, you know, tell us a little bit about working with Alice and whether she was a mentor, role model to you early in your career.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that when I first came to Washington, D.C. for my after my academic stint, it was the early 90s, and I went to CBO. And, of course, Alice had long been gone. She was the founding director of CBO in the 70s, but you know, her legend remained. So the first thing I learned when I came to D.C. and started work at the Tax Analysis Division at CBO was, oh, you got to meet Alice, you know, and you'll get to know Alice really well. So I must have had a chance to meet her sometime in the 90s. And then I became closer to her when I went to the Clinton administration. At the last year of the Clinton administration, I was at the CEA, and Joe Minarek, who was basically her understudy, was the chief economist at OMB. So he became kind of a bridge to Alice. Ended up going to the Hill and working for the Democrats on the Hill after that. And while I was at the Ways and Means Committee, you know, Alice would testify a lot. So I think because I was very focused on the intersection of tax and budget policy rather than just tax policy or just budget policy. And so that kind of aligned me quite well with Alice's expertise and other with the kind of work she had done at Brookings with Bell Sawhill and on restoring fiscal sanity, that series. And so I ended up going from the Ways and Means Committee to work for Alice and Bell at Brookings. And I was the research director for the Budgeting for National Priorities Project. So there, Alice was basically one of my two bosses at Brookings. And, of course, it was at Brookings that I ended up working with Concord more because I became part of that Brookings team on the fiscal wake-up tour. And so I think that's when I started working with Alice really closely because she was basically my boss or one of my two bosses. She became someone who not only would give me advice but would kind of buck me up when things weren't, when I thought people were angry at me or that I was letting someone down or that my work wasn't what they wanted. You know, Alice would always say to me, oh, you're doing a great job. You know, don't worry about it. You're doing great. I think you're doing great work. So she was sort of she was so supportive. And she's, you know, she, for someone who was so accomplished, what was astounding about Alice was she was so just down to earth and, you know, like modest about her own contributions. And she did like everything. She had checked off everything on the list, every kind of possible job, fiscal policy or monetary policy, federal policy, state and local policy. I mean, like, and she had had three children. And so she also raised a family. And I just found it like, man, this woman has so much energy. Like, how does she do it all? And
she was the, just to go back to her resume, she was the founding director of the Congressional Budget Office, 1975 to 1983.
Yeah. But and she then, didn't just start there.
Right. That's right, yeah.
So she had a distinguished career before then.
Well, that's true.
She step had, into that.
She right. had been in, and this is a standard joke in yes. Alice Rivlin circles, she had been in the Johnson administration. And then people around Brookings would say, which one? Ha, ha, ha.
The Lyndon Johnson or the Andrew Johnson?
Oh, that. I get it. I get it.
So, and she would chuckle. And but anyway, she had a career, obviously, before founding CBO. And then after leading the CBO, she was the OMB director. First, she was deputy director.
Mm-hmm.
In OMB. And I can remember thinking at the time, why did she accept that job as deputy director? She's already a legend. But she was, she took the job as deputy director of OMB under Leon Panetta and right. then became OMB director 94 to 96 and then was vice chair of the Fed from 96 to 99. And she told me actually that that was one of her favorite, that might have been her favorite job.
She probably felt like she learned a lot at that job. Because she was not known to be a monetary policy person, and then she had to just kind of dive right in. Right?
She also took time to bail out the District of Columbia. She was chair of the district, and I forget
board.
The name, Control Board.
Financial Control Board, yeah.
Which
I think
was
that's the informal name.
Really an important job that I think she was very proud of. But one thing before moving to Allison, we talk about all of these various jobs. We would go on these fiscal wake-up tour events, and people would always want to recount all the various jobs that she was in. And sometimes she would really get annoyed because she would say, well, that makes it sound like I can't keep a job.
Right.
So we had this thing called the Fiscal Wake-Up Tour from 2005 to 2010, and it involved the Concord Coalition and the idea was to bring together scholars from a conservative background or a more liberal background who didn't necessarily agree on remedies for the long-term fiscal outlook, but could agree on the facts and have a civil discussion about what ought to be done. And former Comptroller General of the United States, David Walker, was, we kind of called him our lead singer of the band to lay out all the facts. And then the we had people from Brookings and people from Heritage, primarily as the speakers giving perspective. And one of those speakers was Allison, who is now with Americans for Prosperity. And Allison, I thought you might talk a little bit about working with Alice Rivlin is kind of a yin and yang on the fiscal wake-up tour.
Yeah, no, delighted to. I think one of the really unique things about the fiscal wake-up tour is at the time, everybody was remarking about, sort of in the policy community, how truly partisan things had become. You know, little did we know how prescient that was. But we were really looking for a solution on how to advance a civilized discussion about fiscal policy and to really get the message out in D.C., but beyond D.C. And so we had this really extraordinary partnership, I think, between a more conservative-leaning organization, scholarly organization like the Heritage Foundation at the time, and a little bit more left-leaning organization in the Brookings Institution. And so we got started off with Concord and Dave Walker and Heritage and Brookings. And, you know, the next thing I know, I am participating, you know, with this legend in her own time, Alice Rivlin. And Diane, you said it perfectly. She was just the most humble person you would ever meet. And, you know, just feel so blessed to have had the opportunity to travel with her. And, you know, kind of be in her wake, but she never treated you that way. Mm-hmm. So she was just a fabulous person. And the things I remember about her the most was she was just unfailingly generous. So she would take, you know, personal time to talk to you about who you were, what you were trying to do, you know, always followed up in personal relationships and just so, so generous. And she was respectful and open. And that was the most fun for me in my work with her on the Fiscal Wake Up Tour, is she really cared and was interested about your point of view, and was extremely respectful, open, gave you good challenge when she didn't agree with you, but it was always respectful. And where she did agree with you, you knew you had a partner for life. And so that's one of the things to me, she was one of the most supportive colleagues in that kind of endeavor. And I think As a result of that, she has, you know, really contributed some bipartisan ideas that are enduring.
The first time that I served on a panel discussion with Alice Rivlin, I was very intimidated, not by Alice, but just by the circumstances. Mm-hmm. And I thought, what am I doing on this? This is like, you know, I'm playing an exhibition match with Tiger Woods or something. Mm-hmm. I mean, why am I? And I thought, poor Alice, she's going to be on this panel with somebody who's, you know, not very well known, the new executive director of the Concord Coalition. And she couldn't have been better. I mean, she was just, you know, I gave my talk of who knows whatever the heck I was saying. And then to have Alice Rivlin say, well, I agree with Bob. I mean, like you said, so generous. And then I was just like, oh, wow. That, you know, it gave you confidence. And if she disagreed with you, it wasn't like, well, you know, the previous speaker has, you know, misled you, blah, blah, blah. There's never anything like that. It would be a very gentle, well, I have a somewhat different perspective on that, and would go from there. She always was trying to get things done, you know, rather than to make her point. This is Facing the Future. I'm Bob Bixby, and I'm talking with Diane Lim, Allison Winter, Phil Smith, about the legacy of Alice Rivlin, the great Alice Rivlin, and some memories of her, you know, years working with her. Phil, we've talked about Alice's scholarship and all of the incredible positions that she held in fiscal and economic policy. You dealt with her in a little bit different
scale from one of the other things that Alice Rivlin was very, very interested in was public education. That's what brought her into the Concord Coalition orbit. And on our fiscal wake-up tour and another events that we did with her, you, as our national field director, often dealt with Alice, and I wonder if you can say a few words about, you know, what it was like dealing with this budgetary legend as a grassroots speaker.
Right. Well, you really get to know somebody when you travel with them. And Allison was talking about the trip in California. We had to drive from Berkeley down to Fresno. I don't know if you've ever made that drive or not.
It's a long way.
And I had already had the chance to interact with Alice a couple of times, and I agree with everything that's been said. I mean, she's just so gracious. And as here I am, basically a junior logistics staffer, right? I mean, she didn't have to give me the time of day, but she jumped up front in the van with me, and we were in the front seat, and
I'd have driven off the road.
Really, I would have.
We chatted and had the best conversation ever going down there, and. You never realize her age, right? Even though there were decades and decades.
She's an indomitable force.
I felt so blessed to have known her in her youthful late 70s.
Yeah. Yes, exactly.
In her exuberant early 80s. And I know a lot of people in the past week or so have been talking about, you know, that they broke the mold when they made Alice Rivlin. There's nobody else like her. Well, I hope that's not the case, because we need more Alice Rivlins. Mm-hmm. And being with her firsthand and seeing a person of substance that still had humor, and you mentioned the Johnson thing. I mean, she let me use that joke over and over at her expense. It was a guaranteed laugh line whenever you would introduce her. And she knew that it would be a laugh line. So she was like, absolutely, you know, feel free to use the Lyndon Johnson versus Andrew Johnson thing. And I bet you with every single person she ever interacted with, and I saw this on the road, she was smarter than the person she was talking to, but that person never knew that, because she had this ability to lift people up to her level, or at least fooling you into thinking that you were at her level, you know, when you were interacting with her. And she was just so polite, but don't confuse that politeness with weakness, because she could serve you your head on the silver platter, and you would know it because she was so polite, right? And feel good about it. And then, like you said, Allison, but when you did agree with her on something, boy, did you have a champion. And I think that was one of my biggest takeaways, is no matter where I go, because we were with the rock stars on the fiscal wake-up tour, but sometimes we don't even go to these sexy destinations like Berkeley. Sometimes we have to go to Tulsa, right? And a lot of times you get the B team, which is me, you know, if you go to some of these. And knowing that Alice Rivlin supported our mission of educating people about fiscal responsibility really helped to give me the energy and the wherewithal, especially if I'm alone out there. You know, you can always think, what would Alice do?
Mm-hmm. speaking of historic references, another humorous thing that she put up with was I was at an event one time, and she was introduced as the George Washington of the CBO. She took the podium. She said, "Well, I suppose that could have been put a little bit differently."
Yes. Well, interestingly, on that same trip in California, went to Fresno and then went to Berkeley. That actually, the day that you picked us up at the hotel to drive to Fresno, was her 80th birthday. I forget how we found out, but she was just that committed to the work, and you know, a major milestone really was of less significance than mm-hmm. to, you know, go and have the opportunity to be on the fiscal wake up tour. Although I do believe she did get to visit her son.
That's a good man, Palo Alto. Yeah. I didn't remember that.
Yeah, when
said
we went
that.
To yeah.
You're exactly
Stanford.
Right.
That
yeah.
was one of our yeah. organizing tricks mm-hmm. in the fiscal wake up tour. If we could find a personal reason for
oh,
one
sure.
of the scholars to go on the road,
a great
that was
travel
good.
Lure.
Especially going out west, because it's so hard to get Washington experts to go out west and to go on her birthday, like you said.
Well, you mentioned Allison. You mentioned her honesty, and it transcended simply policy initiatives. For example, we did an event in Pittsburgh. We did an editorial board meeting,
with a newspaper, and the newspaper ran a story about it the next day, and it ran pictures of us. And I said to Alice at the airport the next morning, this is a lousy picture of me.
really
is terrible. And Alice hadn't seen the paper. And she said, oh, Bob, I've seen so many horrible pictures of myself in the newspaper. I think people always think that they look terrible in the newspaper. So I showed her, I said, well, here's the picture. Here's the picture. And Alice said, oh, well, you're right. That is a, it is a bad picture of you. So, she could buck you up in some circumstances, but there were limits.
But be brutally honest with you in other circumstances.
That was a terrible
picture.
Can we
talk about Alice's optimism?
Absolutely.
Mm. I sort of think of Alice's whole attitude toward fiscal policy as, she personified the whole reason for the fiscal wake-up tour. And like in every setting where she would have a counterpoint to her, like someone from Heritage, her inclination was always to latch on, jump on something where agreement was present.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's been the thing that she always emphasized throughout all of her work on fiscal policy in this town, was always, you know, there are a lot of areas. There's a lot of common ground there, and that we should kind of move to the common ground rather than retreat to our corners and throw barbs at each other.
Right.
Like, and I think she always didn't understand why people were being so stubborn and just, you know, pig-headed about that. The way we debate fiscal policy in this town is that almost everyone else retreats to the corners and throws things at each other, right? And Alice wanted to, everything she's written, everything she's done with her career in fiscal policy has always been to emphasize there are tons of bipartisan ideas where there's agreement if only people would admit that they agree with each other and kind of get to work on those instead of insisting on remaining enemies to each other.
That's so interesting that you bring that up, because I made a few notes before coming down here today, and I wrote unfailingly positive.
Positive.
Because she was.
Yes.
Even in kind of thinking about fiscal policy, not very positive, and the direction of the conversation, not very positive, but she was you felt lighter being around her because of
she
that
was always
positivity.
Like, we can do this.
Yeah.
You know, it's a big problem, but we can
but
do
we can
it
do
together.
It. Yeah.
Right? It was always together.
Right.
Even in the worst of times, right? She was at our dinner last December, and she was clearly already sick, but she took the time to come to the Concord Coalition dinner. I don't know that I would have done that if I were in her shoes. I probably would have been laid up. But she was there and in good spirits.
Well, let me just mention.
She was.
Yeah, let me just mention some of the many ways in which she worked with the Concord Coalition over the years. She came to one of our very first policy forums that we did, and I'm talking about going back to 1993 or 94. With Paul Tsongas and Warren Rudman, and she was one of the guest speakers. And later we've been talking today about the Fiscal Wake-Up Tour. But she was also part of another thing we did called the Strengthening of America Commission, which was basically Sam Nunn, our co-chair at the time, and Pete Domenici, who Alice had worked with on a fiscal initiative, held a bunch of forums here in D.C. and brought together policy experts. And Alice worked on that. She also, I should mention, I worked with her on that Rivlin-Domenici task force on deficit reduction. But she also was involved in our most recent initiative, which we haven't quite announced yet, but it's on fiscal responsibility and economic growth. And we've drafted a bunch of scholars to write papers on various subjects, and she has also one with Joe Antos from the American Enterprise Institute on healthcare reform. So really, from the beginning of the Concord Coalition through up until the end, she has been involved not only in scholarly work but in the grassroots stuff that we do.
And she was working on a book.
I was going to mention the book.
And she was determined to finish it before she passed away. Like, apparently up to the last hours of her life, she was still working on it. And I think at least one of her children, maybe two of them, are going to finish it for her.
Wow.
And I know that the theme that she's emphasizing in that book, because one of her sons kind of gave us a preview of it, was the notion that we have to work together.
Right. Mm-hmm.
This is, yeah, like, she basically says, this is ridiculous, guys. You know, come on. We should have been able to work this out decades ago. We should have been able to get together on this. And that's kind of her message. And so I think her children, who are finishing her book, really want there to be some lasting, you know, tribute to Alice by, like, people, policymakers just listening to her.
Well, I thought of her as an expert on healthcare,
mm-hmm.
but I also thought of her as an expert on tax policy,
yeah,
on fiscal policy, on infrastructure, on state and local government,
yes,
financing.
Yes.
I mean, you know, she really ran the gamut.
She did. You never quite knew what she was going to pull out of her hat in a conversation, you know, whether that was during the, you know, sort of presentations and the panels that we would do, whether it was an editorial board or just in a conversation in a van driving to Fresno.
Right.
You just never knew what kind of experience she was going to have. And then all the things that she did to enrich her personal life, like they went on long walking tours in Europe and it sounded so, you know, so fabulous. So just really an incredibly rich person.
I thought it was fitting this past week that we found out who the new CBO director is going to be, Phil Swagel.
Yeah.
And he said several nice things about Alice. And that's across the aisle. You know, I mean,
right,
the CBO director is supposed to be nonpartisan, of course, but we know what people's backgrounds are. And the things that he said about her and that how he would like to be like her, I thought that was so fitting.
That sent a really good signal. And, you know, I look at Alice's career somewhat in the framework of CBO because that's what the Concord Coalition does. We work on fiscal policy and we use CBO numbers. I think it's important in her assessing her legacy that the CBO that we know today was created, in effect, by Alice Rivlin, and with all, she really was the George Washington of the CBO in the same sense that it wasn't clear that the United States of America was going to be what it turned out to be until we had 8 years of George Washington as president kind of, you know, setting mm-hmm. the standard. And Alice Rivlin set the standard on CBO for credibility and integrity and independence. She was determined that's what the agency was going to be. And it was not a foregone conclusion when it was established in 1975 that is what it was going to be. There were certainly members of Congress who were thinking, well, maybe this is just going to be a numbers shop for the majority and they'll crank mm-hmm. out the numbers mm-hmm. that they want. And Alice had other ideas, that it was truly going to be an independent mm-hmm. entity that would give honest numbers and speak truth to power, as CBO has done on occasion, sometimes giving the ruling majority or the administration impact on numbers that you know didn't please them.
Right.
And really that, they all really, like Phil Swagel, the new CBO director, all go back and kind of cite the example that Alice set for the agency. This is Facing the Future. I'm your host for today, Bob Bixby. And we're discussing the legacy of Alice Rivlin with Diane Lim, Allison Winter, and Phil Smith.
So I think one important thing to point out is, in addition to her extraordinary ability and accomplishments, is the fact that she did a lot of firsts as a woman.
Mm.
So, you know, there was a fair amount of controversy about her appointment to CBO as a woman. And I think for me, one of the things that I appreciated about her so much is this, you know, big star in the universe is taking time to mentor so many women mm-hmm. In her career. You know, women much, much younger, women more contemporary. That was fundamentally important to me. And just having someone that you could aspire to be as a woman. And a woman in economics, you know, Diane, mm-hmm. you know this better than I do with your academic academics is, you know, that's a tough road to hoe. And, you know, she just did it.
Yeah. She was very encouraging to me, I think because I was an economist mm-hmm. and a mother. And she would kind of, in her optimistic way, she would say, yeah, I know you're really busy, but hang in there. It's okay. Yeah. Your kids love you. It'll be fine. Yeah. And, you know, when I started my Economist Mom blog back at when I left the Hill, when I started at Concord, mm-hmm. actually, Alice, when we first talked about the idea, she was like, oh, that's fabulous. Mm-hmm. She was like, maybe I can guest blog as Economist Grandma. And awesome. So I sort of put that idea out there when I launched the blog in my acknowledgments. I said Alice had encouraged me to do this, and she might even come on here. But she never did. But she was always like, I always kind of threatened that she would. She's always out there.
You know, it's interesting you mentioned her giving career advice on a one of the fiscal wake-up tour stops, and this was also in California. I don't know why everything seemed to happen in California, but we must have gone there with Alice a couple of times. About the time, Diane, that you were getting ready to leave the Hill and you were mm-hmm. considering job opportunities, yeah. either at Concord or some other organizations yeah. in town, I remember sitting at a coffee shop somewhere in California and telling Dave Walker and Alice Rivlin that I was thinking about hiring Diane as our chief economist. And Alice said, well, I've told her she should accept one of the other offers.
She said that to you?
Yeah.
That is so funny.
That's, I remember and sitting there really? Having coffee, but I didn't know you yet because you were on the Hill.
Right.
Oh, that's
I so did I was, ask her bit, for yeah. advice. That is so funny. She's so honest.
Yeah, no, she's, and she told me exactly why. And I said,
why
well,
did she say why?
She thought that you would have a better academic experience at one of the other organizations.
That was one bit of advice that I am glad that that Alice that was ignored. But in that case,
well, she also said, "Oh well, but you'd be great at Concord too. They'd be lucky to have you. That you'd have a great time."
But that's just her that positive way of giving her frank thoughts.
Right.
I know.
But,
yeah.
But very positive. You know, another thing that we were chatting about before we went on air here is how the things that she has written and the way she speaks are, they just stand the test of time.
Yes.
Oh, well, she's such a good writer.
She's just a fabulous communicator.
Yeah, communicator. Yeah.
Yeah, and that, you know, her writing and her speaking and so forth. So I pulled out, before I came down here, I pulled out from my archive file an old, old set of op-eds. And this is sort of one of the things that we did a lot in the fiscal wake-up tours, they would have in the editorial boards that you guys all reached out to, sort of a right-left presentation of an editorial. And I wrote one, Why Our Domestic Entitlements Could Doom Our Children. I swear I did not write that headline.
Yeah, they all write the headline. Yeah.
And then opposite that, on the left side, was penned by Alice Rivlin and Isabel Sawhill, Why Deficits and Debt Render the United States Vulnerable. And their writing, you know, you hear Alice's voice throughout the whole thing. It's just absolutely timeless. Mm-hmm. And sort of that gentle, frank thoughtfulness about, mm-hmm. you know, what the mission is.
I went back and looked at some of the videos because I was looking at things to post on our website because I thought people would like to see Alice Rivlin rather than just writing about her.
Right.
And that really struck me, Allison. It's just I started listening to some of the things, watching these videos online, and it was if she was giving a contemporary mm-hmm. speech, which is not only saying something about Alice, but about the whole fiscal debate.
Yeah.
Hasn't yes. gained much traction over the years. But it's so very logical. She would lay things out in just such a logical way and a non-ideological way and a sense of urgency, but not panic, you know,
right.
not bombast. If we don't do anything, everything's going to hell soon. I mean,
right.
So I would urge people that want to watch that to go to our website, ConcordCoalition.org. And look at the tribute to Alice Rivlin and scroll down to the links and watch some of the speeches that she gave on the fiscal wake-up tour, always without charts. She was the one that the rest of us were relying on charts.
With the yellow pen get up and give
which
them
made
most,
my job easier because I didn't have to load have up to any charts.
Well, and I think that was very effective because, you know, when with everyone else overloading the audience with charts, you know, when Alice would start to speak, you kind of lean forward in your chair and you want to listen because it's more like she's telling you a story, right?
Yeah.
Like, come closer, I have something to tell you. We can get this done. This shouldn't be that hard. There are lots of areas of common ground. And it's just more compelling to make that argument without a chart, right? Because you're, like, more engaging with the audience and they're seeing you more as a just a genuine person rather than an expert with charts.
Rather than next slide.
Exactly.
And I think a lot of that was came out of her interest in public education. I mean, she always was aware that, you know, just making the fact-based arguments that we usually do, which are important, you need to, you know, establish the facts. But when you're trying to communicate with a broader audience, it's better sometimes to set out a narrative and to tell people. And boy, she was just never lost her interest in engaging the public and finding out if people had problems with a particular point of view, why it was they had those problems, and crediting their values and you know, seeing if you come up with some sort of compromise that made things work.
And that was a big part of her fortitude in really leading the work that the Fiscal Commission did following the, you know, the budget debt limit deal is, you know, she was that one, I think, who was just truly committed. And when it was clear that, you know, there were some too far apart in your corners kind of stuff, she's the one who persevered. And she's the one who came up with, you know, a lot of those driving, defining ideas that, you know, that are enduring.
Well, I know I mentioned the Rivlin-Domenici Deficit Reduction or Debt Reduction Task Force. This meant simultaneously to the Bowles-Simpson Commission, and Alice was the only person who was a member of both.
Both.
So it's kind of interesting because she had to keep, both were meeting confidentially, so she was kind of keeping, but it's significant that everybody trusted her
to be
member of both, and that she was in such demand that if you were going to be credible as a commission, you had to have Alice Rivlin on it. But she and Pete Domenici worked so well together and had such great respect for one another. And dealing with us commissioners, they laid down a couple of simple rules, and one of them was any preconceived notions that you have here, leave at the door. In other words, if you've got anything that's off the table for you, don't come here, because we're gonna have to look at things that question assumptions that we all might have, and we might have to make compromises. So they steered us to recommendations on health care, on Social Security, on taxes, that a lot of us as individuals would have been uncomfortable with, but were willing to sign on to as a package, because they were determined. They made it clear, we are going to have an agreement here.
Yeah.
So think about that. We're going to have an agreement here. So figure out what you need to get that agreement. And, you know, I think that the things that we came up with, again, stand the test of time. Let's just let's each have a final word about remembering Alice Rivlin and the legacy that she has. It's awful hard to sum up, but Phil, what are your thoughts?
Well, as I think back on the life and legacy of Alice Rivlin, I think about her intellect. I think about her caliber, her command, her mixture of poise and grace. I hope we haven't seen the last of the Alice Rivlins. I hope that her life will inspire us, that just because her long 88 years of life is over, and it wasn't enough, I wish we had more, But I hope that the end of her life doesn't mean the end of her legacy. I hope the legacy of Alice Rivlin will live on, and I think it will, because she's done a lot of things to make sure it will.
Mm-hmm. So. Allison?
I just couldn't say it any better than that at all. So I'm going to tell a tiny little anecdote about one of my connections with Alice. Is we were having lunch one day, and I had just gotten remarried, and she was asking me if I was changing my name. And, you know, for a woman who's had a long career, that's, you know, a challenge. So she asked me what my new name was going to be, and it's Winters, which is her husband's. And her legal name. Okay. So that was Allison Winters, Winter.
I love it.
So that was my little special connection. With her.
Okay. And see, I've been calling you Winter, and it's Winter.
It's Winter.
And she was Winter.
She was Winter.
Sid. Singular.
There you are.
Yeah, her husband Sid is Winter. Yeah.
Winters is coming no matter what.
I love it. I knew there was a Game of Thrones reference coming.
I had to.
Over to Diane.
Yeah, she's, I mean, Alice is just such a brilliant, wonderful person. You know, apart from all of her stardom in the fiscal policy world, she was just like at a very earthly level, down to earth level. She was a brilliant, I mean, just a wonderful friend to have and a wonderful example about how to live your life really fully.
In a environment that's increasingly partisan here in Washington, there was not anybody that didn't respect Alice Rivlin across the aisle. And the tributes to her have just been overwhelming. And you got to think about why is that. And it's because of the integrity of her work and that infectious joy she brought to it, that determination to work with anybody, to try to get things done, listen to the other side, and without sacrificing your own views, your own integrity. She's a role model, and I hope we haven't seen the last of her, as Phil said, the last of her like. But she was a wonderful, wonderful person, and we at the Concord Coalition are so privileged to have worked with her over the years, a great woman, a great scholar, a great person, Alice Rivlin. This is Facing the Future. I'm Bob Bixby. Thank you for listening.